On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, President Bush's longtime political advisor and man dubbed the architect, Karl Rove, is resigning. He helped Bush win the White House twice. He's the mastermind behind years of Republican rule, but also the man who stoked visions of a permanent Republican majority. That's already gone in Congress. Karl Rove has been loved and feared and hated. Now he's headed out of town this hour on Point. Rove's legacy and lasting stamp on American politics and presidential power. We will hear in this hour from people who have known and seen Karl Rove from many angles. We're joined first by John Fund, writer and columnist for OpinionJournal.com and member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. John Fund, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, John.
We'll get a lot of angles on this story, but let's just go right to the bottom line first. John Fund, what's the legacy of Karl Rove?
A controversial one and a mixed one. He will go down in history as perhaps the most influential White House aide of modern times. He will also go down as someone who occasionally overshadowed his boss and became a lightning rod for enormous criticism. Right now on Capitol Hill, Karl Rove is the leading White House pinata.
A net gain for the Republican Party, John, over his time? I mean, he brought the White House in twice. He had visions of a permanent majority that's already evaporated a bit. But, you know, when the GOP looks back on this man, are they going to say Karl Rove put us on the right track?
Well, the real fear in the Republican Party right now is that the Bush administration might turn the Republicans into a permanent minority. But having said that, I think the legacy of Karl Rove will be determined in large part by 2008. Can the Republicans, despite the fact that Bush's popularity ratings are not good, can they retain the White House? Can they make gains in Congress? If that's the case, then I think you will very much see Karl Rove have a very burnished image. On the other hand, if the Republicans lose the White House, they're going to blame George Bush for it, and they will blame in part Karl Rove.
Jack Beatty, when you blame George Bush in politics, you've got to be talking about Karl Rove. August 31st, he says, he will be out. He sat down with John's colleague, Paul Gigot, on Saturday to give him the sort of the news ahead of the announcement. We'll look at a lot of details in this hour, Jack, but bottom line, how do you see the legacy of this man?
Well, I think under Karl Rove, we saw an extraordinary extension of politics to policy. I mean, the White House policy shop really was an extension of his political ambitions. And we also saw an extraordinary extension of politics over government. And that's the most controversial area of his tenure. The U.S. attorney scandals, that's just one example. The tutorials he gave to various departments, including apparently the State Department, about the election and which candidates were vulnerable, that his operatives gave, that sort of thing. That kind of extension of politics over the operations of government, I think, is the part that's going to get him. It could get him in serious trouble with the Congress, but it's also going to darken his legacy.
John, Karl Rove is, by both detractors and supporters, often described as a genius. If there's genius here, what's the texture of it? What's the nature of it? How do you see it?
You know, I often believe that people who are viewed as knaves in Washington or geniuses, the case is often overstated in both directions. I think Karl Rove is a very savvy political operator. I think he understood his boss, George W. Bush, his strengths and weaknesses very well. He also understood that in a country that was very polarized after the 2000 election, you had two choices. You could either run a coalition government in which you basically compromised your principles, or you could run a polarizing election campaign. I think he might have erred a little too much towards the latter, but he made that decision. It came with benefits and it came with costs. I wouldn't consider Karl Rove a genius. I would consider Karl Rove a very smart implementer of George W. Bush's political impulses and political desires. I don't think he nearly as much as many people thought decided what Bush would do. I think he was the implementer, and he was generally an effective one, but clearly his fortunes and that of George W. Bush, you know, go up and down together. Right now, they're in a down cycle.
And what about Jack's observation that Karl Rove pulled politics across some kind of line and deep into government policy, into government itself, in a way that is without precedent, at least in recent times?
I think if you read the history of Lyndon Johnson's White House or Richard Nixon's White House, you might certainly have some recent precedents on that score. The lessons of Watergate, the lessons of the Vietnam debacle, I think have been largely forgotten over the last generation. Let's just say Carl certainly made a mistake in that he ended up after the 2004 election holding both the political hat and the policy hat. I think that was a division of labor that was unfortunate both for the administration and probably for the country. It ended up with a Social Security reform which was very promising but which didn't go anywhere. No bill was even presented to Congress. It also ended up with, I think, a complete misreading of the country's mood on Iraq and a complete misreading of the need for a fundamental reorientation of the Iraq strategy. So if Karl Rove had left at the end of Bush's first term, I think he would have left with a controversial but a much more positive legacy. Leaving now, it's much more mixed because he made mistakes in the second term, and they were serious ones.
Jack, look back at the years of Richard Nixon, LBJ, for that matter, FDR. Politics has come into policy before. Is there a new spin on it, or has there been under Rove?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, we've had a lot of that in our history. FDR, speaking of Lyndon Johnson, called off the IRS. They were investigating Congressman Johnson's activities. He actually called them off. So, yes, there's been a lot of interference in government by politics. But what I'm just struck with is how how central it was to what he was all about. I mean, he saw that. I think he looked at government the way a city machine looks at it, that the government was an instrument of the Republican Party policy. And I think that the way he sliced that, which was to the meaning electioneering, meaning, you know, for example, one of the controversial legacies is the prosecution of Don Siegelman, a governor of former governor of Alabama, Democrat. There is some indication out there that that was a hit job on the part of the prosecutor down there, and that Rove had boasted about that. Now, of course, Siegelman may well have been guilty, but the fact is that's the kind of thing that we saw under him, and I think we saw in some other of these U.S. attorney cases, and I think it was at least since LBJ and since Nixon, this was an unusual degree of using the government the way a city boss would.
Certainly, an unusual degree of influence over a sitting president. Rove headed to Texas with the president on Air Force One today. The president's headed down to Crawford. Karl Rove headed soon to Texas, he says. Full time back home. Let's go to Texas right now. Joining us from Austin, Texas is Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, author of Bush's Brain, famously How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush and the Architect, George Bush's Word, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power. Wayne Slater, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're great. How's the news being received in Texas that Karl Rove is coming home?
Well, I suspect the folks here in Texas knew that this day was going to come at some point. I think talking briefly with a few folks who've known Karl for about as long as I have, 20 years, I think the thinking was he was going to hang on longer, that he would be the last guy to turn off the lights. But frankly, in retrospect, this makes sense.
Makes sense what? Because Congress is out of town, they can't throw stones from Capitol Hill as it goes, the subpoenas are what they are, why now?
Well, basically, this is a signal, if we needed another one, that this administration is over. The classic signal is the 2006 election, the off-year election before the end of a presidency to signal lame duck status. And this president is a lame duck. There really isn't anything more than that Karl can do. He's become a lightning rod. He's become a problem. Your earlier guest talked about Karl's approach, which was an effort to create within the federal government almost a political machine. That was exactly his goal. Karl has had two goals in life. One was to take George W. Bush to high office. The other was to establish this enduring Republican majority. And if 2006 proved anything, it proved that this second goal had failed.
John Fund with us from the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, 08 will be the proof of the pudding. If he comes back then, he may have had it after all. I mean, well, if the GOP does.
And it's interesting because, as John knows, Carl went into the Oval Office after the 2006 election and said to the president, and subsequently said to others, this election was much closer than people think. Sure, we lost the House and the Senate, but a shift of 33,000 votes on the Senate side, 70,000 votes nationwide on the congressional side, we could have held at least one, if not both, houses of Congress. And so 2008 will be the measure. But frankly, I've been out there. I've been in Iowa. I've been in New Hampshire. I've been in other states, even here in Texas, and there is not very much enthusiasm right now for both the Republican Party and for the politics that Carl engendered. Remember, he was a guy who was important not only because he's brilliant, and not only because he was marvelously successful in George Bush's political life and in the 2002 congressional race. He's a guy who really brought to the fore another kind, a new level of very ruthless politics. And it's a politics designed to succeed by division.
Ann's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Ann, what do you think?
Well, I believe Karl Rove is nothing more than a catalyst in the deterioration of the American political process. I don't think, you know, anybody has contributed more to ideas that undermine the checks and balances inherent in the system. You know, campaigning has become nothing more than marketing with sound bites. And the sad thing is, I think he could go and support any puppet by his means. You know, Bush was clearly a puppet to the Cheney-Rumsfeld-Wolfowitz organization. And I think he could support any incompetent and get him in power by these you know, deteriorating political means. It's shameful. I think he's nothing more than a criminal.
John Fund, Wayne Slater says succeed by division as the fundamental strategy. Our caller Ann from Des Moines says, you know, Karl Rove's instinct was to undermine checks and balances, and you hear it. She doesn't like him. But what about this? The charges there?
Well, clearly, because the parties are more or less equally divided, the stakes are enormous in politics, and things have deteriorated completely. I have to say, you know, I was not the biggest fan of the Clinton administration. I never called anyone in the Clinton administration a criminal, and you have people now on the phone calling Karl Rove a criminal. So it works both ways. The polarization that Karl Rove contributed to was certainly met with equal ferocity by Howard Dean and the Netroots people, the Daily Cause people. All you have to do is go to their website, and that's been around since 2002 and 2003. And both sides have contributed to the deterioration of the discourse, and it is deplorable, and I don't see an easy way out of it.
Wayne Slater, mud on everybody's hands here, John Fund says.
Well, I think that's probably right. I rarely disagree with John Fund, but no, I think that's right. I think it's unfair to say that Bush was an incompetent. I think those of us who know him many of us think he's made extraordinary mistakes in some of the decision making and sort of some of the influence that others have had on him. But he's not an incompetent. He's not a total puppet. And when we wrote the book, Bush's Brain, we didn't mean to say that Carl was the sum and sole brain of George Bush. But what he was a figure who knew how to elect candidates. And he knew how to do it in a level, at a degree that we had not seen before. And that's why, sure, there's blood on everybody's hand. I remember talking to George Bush here in Austin in 1999, before he went to Washington, and he truly believed, and Carl absolutely believed, this sounds naive now, that he was going to be able to go to Washington and actually bring many of these Democrats around, and what he feels he found there was a very unreceptive, dark and divided community in Washington that made that approach impossible. At least that's the president's view.
Even among his own party members?
Oh, and that, I think, is really one of the real tragedies here. And I think Carl has mud on his hands about this. The strategy to govern, or at least be elected by a strategy of division, one group against another, which normally you have Republicans against Democrats, ultimately became Republican against Republican. When you push an immigration agenda and aren't listening to the constituencies within your own group, when you are not as receptive or not as responsive as some Christian conservatives had hoped this administration would be, although they're very happy with the Supreme Court nominations, you begin to eat away at by either small or larger measure elements of your own family, your own group. And when you play a game that's 50% plus one, divide the field and just barely win, which has always been Carl's strategy, then when you begin to lose not the Democrats, but your own folks in any measure, you really begin to lose.
Jack Beatty, our caller Ann says, you know, this man helped skew American politics that, in her word, is criminal. Of course, you know, that's got a technical meaning, but it's also got a kind of thematic meaning. John Fund says, you know, the game is being played dirty on all sides here. How do you see Karl Rove in that debate? You know, Ann's got a point that many will share and others will snort at. What do you say, Jack?
Well, you know, I understand what she's saying, but I do think she blurs the continuity with Clinton methods, really. You know, it was Clinton who brought the permanent campaign to Washington. And an aspect of that was how the Clintons dealt with their enemies, which was, you know, sort of full court press, destroy them if you can. And, of course, that came back to haunt Clinton himself. So I don't see that there's any – I mean, Rove has taken it another notch, and he's taken it to the electorate where he sees groups that he sees issues, social issues he could polarize on, and he used them. And he also used the war and security issues that way to, you know, paint the Democrats as weak. I don't think he was in that respect dirtier than anyone else in terms of electioneering. It's interesting when you look at the at what congressmen say about him. I mean, Jim Leach in Iowa lost his seat, but he did it proudly because the Rove people wanted him to destroy his opponent, and he said, "I don't run that kind of a campaign," and he wouldn't do it. And then there are the stories of congressmen driving in their car someplace and Karl Rove berating them over the phone on the cell phone, and one congressman said, "I had to pull over to stop from, you know, crying practically." And then there's an anecdote in the current Atlantic about Dick Armey, who was then the minority leader, going to the White House and asking Rove, the president, to sign a piece of paper that Clinton had done routinely, and that Armey would give to the first tourist he saw, and Rove said, "Oh no, we won't sign that. That'll probably just wind up on eBay." I mean, this was a man of some personal animus. I mean, he wasn't just, in other words, this angry politics that he, I think, he was a master of, came out of him. There's something very angry in this man, and I think it was projected in all these ways.
Wayne Slater, what about the sense, I think many Democrats had, certainly until last fall, that love him or hate him, Karl Rove was running circles around them, that he was just playing the game, whoever set the rules, at a higher, tougher, more fiendishly ingenious level than they were pulling off?
I think it was true. I mean, I think not only was that perception there, but he simply was better. He was running the game, gaming the system better than the Democrats. I can't tell you how many times I would go places, and I'm sure John and maybe Jack have had the same experience, where you'd go places and people would say, "Who's the Democratic Karl Rove? Who can we have on our side that will be equivalent to Karl Rove?" And I can remember the run-up to the 2006 race. If you remember, this was a debacle in the making for the Republican Party. But Carl was, typical Carl, very cheery publicly, saying, "No, the numbers, look, my numbers show this, you know, Rove's math." Mm-hmm. And he seemed so cheery. I went to a book festival event, and a prominent Democrat, came to me and said, this was like a month out before the race, said, "What does he know that we don't know?" He got into the minds of Democrats, and what we learned in 2006 was that he's not perfect. He is neither the genius, the extraordinary, omnipotent genius that some have suggested, nor is he the kind of flawed figure, I think, that others would like to think.
Let's take a couple calls here. First, from Mount Gilead, Ohio. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Great show. I wanted to ask your guests if Well, let me say this. Some have suggested that Dick Cheney is one of the more powerful vice presidents, which is probably true. And I'm curious if perhaps he is in that role, and if Karl Rove has become so vital because possibly George Bush is a relatively weak president. In other words, how would Karl Rove have worked, say, with under Nixon or maybe even Reagan? And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Let me get a related from William in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I have an observation I'd like to make. In terms of leadership, I think what Bush has done is I don't think Bush is following anybody like a puppet, like some suggest. I think he's got some basic tenets of the way he wanted to run the presidency. He surrounded himself with the people that he felt like militarily and politically and so forth, economically, could do the job. And I think he's like a lot of good leaders. He's got the people that he trusts, and he stays out of the way as long as they're moving in the direction that he wants them to make it in. I think it's a great underestimation of George Bush to think he's as "quote unquote stupid," as a lot of people want to paint him out to be.
So Bush is the genius, William?
I'm sorry.
So George Bush is the genius?
I don't think he's a genius, but I think he knows what he's doing, and a lot of people basically want to paint him as a person that's being led around by all these people. When in fact, I think he set the agenda and said, "You guys go do the job."
He built the team. John Fund, a couple of big things on the table there. But what about it? People say, you know, William says it's George Bush at the heart of it. Others say, no, this is a Dick Cheney presidency. Others have given that to Karl Rove. It can't be all of those.
I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make in observing politics is assuming that because they disagree with someone, the other person is somehow dim or stupid. I think it's often a perception issue. Let me give you a thought experiment. We have a replete history in the mainstream media of Republican political figures who were viewed as dim. We're from Gerald Ford to Dan Quayle to Ronald Reagan for much of his career. Remember, you know, he was often called an amiable dunce, to George W. Bush. And I just have to challenge the audience. Please name me a leading Democratic political figure who has ever developed a reputation in the mainstream media for being stupid.
But John, let me go.
I think it's a perception issue rather than necessarily the reality. I think we would do much better not to accord, stupidity to somebody unless we have direct and clear evidence. Bush is inarticulate. I grant you that there may be a certainly a problem there with words, but no one would argue that Bush, I think, is stupid if they've spent any time significantly with him.
Let's leave IQ out of it and talk about influence. Clearly, it's interesting here because you have a vice president who is one of the most influential in history and a deputy chief of staff and political advisor, one of the most influential in history. So who's been the big wheel behind the president, and what about the relative weight of these two, Cheney and Rove, John?
I think that they have been influential in their own way and in a different way. Cheney is the fellow who sits silently at meetings, and then he has one lunch a week with the president and also some private meetings where he communicates directly one-on-one what his views are. He's sort of the ultimate sounding board. Rove is the implementer. Rove goes out and knows what Bush's general agenda is, and he goes out and tries to make it happen. So Cheney is more of the armchair sounding board, and Rove is the political mechanic, the head of the machine.
Wayne, is that your read?
A bit. The flaw, I think, in George Bush, and John's exactly right, the flaw is not that George W. Bush is stupid. He's not. He's intellectually pretty sharp guy, actually, if you really watch. The flaw is that he is overly influenced. His method of operating is to be overly influenced by a few people who are around him. These are people he chooses to be around him. Carl was one who was with him from the very beginning. Dick Cheney is someone I remember talking to the president about, that he thought Dick Cheney, he had such admiration for Dick Cheney. He thought Dick Cheney was funny. He thought he was bright. He thought he understood Washington in a way that the president, the soon-to-become president, knew he needed. The problem is that Bush is overly influenced by people, a small circle. He was as a governor, and he is now as president, who, when they give him bad advice or advice that ultimately turns out to be wrong, then he really didn't know it going in. He's easily influenced, but only by those he allows in the small circle. That doesn't mean he's stupid, but I have to question his judgment.
And, of course, Karl Rove set right in that circle. John, yeah?
No, I agree. Most of Bush's mistakes have been, I think, because there's the stubbornness is directly related to what Wayne says. The stubbornness is, well, my and my inner circle, we all agree, and there's sort of a reinforcing yes man, yes sir attitude there, and I think that the stubbornness comes from the fact, well, Bush says, well, this isn't just my opinion. Everyone I talk to agrees with it.
Let's go to Mark in Bettendorf, Iowa. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you
I'm
see, Mark?
I'm so sorry. The gentleman from the Wall Street Journal became kind of affronted when one of your callers called Karl Rove a criminal. And maybe from the standpoint of the argument she was making as far as his political advising, maybe that was strong. However, Karl Rove and this entire administration, there are many that believe that he has engaged in criminal acts, subversion of the Constitution, which they were all sworn to defend, acting as if, behaving as if they're above the law, whether you want to talk about the means that we got into this war, whether you want to talk about the attorney scandal or many other things that are well documented. I mean, there is a difference. And to compare Rove or Bush or anybody to Clinton, I mean, maybe political gamesmanship, yes, but this administration, these members believe they're above the law.
Mark, let me pick that up, Jack, first to you and then you, John Fund. Jack, Mark says, wait a minute, I see a subversion of the Constitution. How big do you want to get?
Well, I mean, I agree in terms of the national security wiretapping. That does seem to me to have been illegal and unconstitutional, and I think it was a disgrace that the 50-odd Democrats folded on it a week ago. But as I understand it, that view of the presidency, you know, presidential power was one pushed very strongly by Dick Cheney and one supported by memos from the ever faithful Justice Department led by Alberto Gonzalez. And I don't know that Rove is directly implicated in that.
John, we've just got you for another minute here. What do you say? Subversion of the Constitution? You know, many people do worry about presidential power, executive authority, the Constitution under this administration, and Rove's right at the middle of it.
One of the mistakes that some critics of the Clinton administration made is that they saw crimes behind every Bush during those years. I think that any time you take policy disagreements and you say that this is criminal behavior, I think you're misreading the dictionary. Criminal behavior is you are found guilty by the law.
John Fund, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
We're talking this hour about Karl Rove, headed out of the White House and home to Texas at the end of this month, he said. Jack Beatty is here. Wayne Slater joins us from Austin, Texas. He's senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. We're joined right now as well by David Gergen, served as presidential advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, now director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, editor-at-large for U.S. News and World Report. David Gergen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
How do you see the legacy of this man and his extraordinary power in this administration?
Well, it's not fully written yet, but I think that many commentators at this point, I mean, the Bush presidency has become such a lightning rod, so divisive that, you know, some people are going to hate Rove and some people are going to love him. I guess more will hate. But I think the truth is the story is yet to be fully written. What I do think what we know is that Karl Rove's largest enterprise in coming to Washington was to work with George W. Bush to establish an enduring Republican majority along the lines of what William McKinley did back in the late 19th century. And William McKinley is sort of Karl Rove's icon for this purpose, his model. And they were doing remarkably well in that project in 2000, 2002, and 2004. Their party gained seats in Congress, and that has not happened under any president since Franklin Roosevelt. Ronald Reagan, the Republicans, lost the seats while he was in his presidency. Bill Clinton, the Democrats, lost seats. So up until through 2004, in terms of their political gains, you have to say that Roe was making remarkable progress, and he was the genius behind a lot of that. But since then, of course, it's all gone downhill, especially because of the war. And now I think that the chances of them establishing a durable Republican majority is just about zilch. And if anything, the Democrats are about to take over, may well be about to take over all three. They're certainly going to take over the House, the Senate. They've taken done that already, and they've got a good chance of taking the presidency. So that large political enterprise right now is failing.
Was he on to something fundamental about the American electorate, that somehow politics and the status quo had drifted away from a more fundamental conservatism that really defines the American electorate? Or was he just more ruthless and he misread where the heart of the electorate lies, David?
Well, I think he was ruthless, and he established that. Wayne can talk about what he did in Texas. The Bush and Rove rolled over the opposition. And when Karl Rove started in Texas politics, the Democrats controlled Texas politics. They had a 9-to-1 advantage in the House there, and they owned every seat at the statewide level. Now the Republicans have every seat. That has a lot to do with Rove, and he is ruthless. I do think that what he saw was a potential for a rolling realignment, and that was he really felt coming in, having read these tons and tons of books as he did. He brought 54 boxes of books with him to Washington. He saw that possibility. I think they made some huge mistakes in the early going, and instead of governing and trying to go and build big majorities in the Congress, as they did with No Child Left Behind, their early domestic initiative, they tried to roll the opposition. There is, by the way, a remarkably interesting and timely piece, a cover piece in the Atlantic magazine.
Joshua Green's, yes.
On the Rove presidency.
Terrific piece.
Which I think makes it clear that they swerved, and in swerving, I think they went right off the road.
Is the rolling realignment still there to be had, or is it evaporated in the morning mist?
I think that's pretty much gone smash, and you'd have to start all over again now. There are so many disenchanted independents. Take the Hispanics that they wanted to go after. That I thought they did in a quite appropriate way through their immigration bill, but that went down. And now the Hispanics are angry, and they're lining up behind the Democrats. That was a critical part of any coalition to build to go for a durable Republican majority. I think that that dream, if it's ever going to materialize, will come in under some other president, not this one.
Let's go to Susan in Dracut, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hello. I just been fascinated with Karl Rove because my husband went to high school with Karl Rove
in Utah.
In Mount Olympus High School in Utah, mm-hmm. in Salt Lake City. My husband lost his first election to Karl Rove. He was the my husband was the campus coordinator for the Bobby Kennedy campaign, and Karl Rove was the campus coordinator for Eugene McCarthy. He was a Democrat at the time.
Wow, that's way back.
Yes, way back. And my husband says he distinctly remembers that they got together with school administrators, decided on a bunch of rules and regulations for the campaign, and Karl Rove proceeded to break every single one of them. And my husband went on to be editor of the student newspaper, and Karl Rove was president of the student body there. And my husband got in big trouble because he ran an editorial cartoon of Karl Rove seated on a throne. It was Mount Olympus High School because it's right below Mount Olympus in Salt Lake City. Anyway, he's had a long history of being. My husband said he asked Karl why he went over to the Republican Party later, and he said it was because I have more of a chance to advance in the Republican Party instead of the Democratic Party.
Wow, we're all the way back in high school with Karl Rove there in Utah. Susan, thanks very much for those tales. Wayne, I want to get you on those, but let's get one more here first. That's just Susan. Thank you. That's a terrific blast from the past. Let's go to Bruce in Ayer, Massachusetts.
Yeah, when I think of Karl Rove, I think of two quotes. One is from Bill Clinton, who said, the Republicans, they have a destruction machine, and we don't. And Karl Rove ran that destruction machine, and I think it came the level of bile and viciousness that he brought to campaigns, particularly I remember the Max Cleland campaign, where they just smeared this triple amputee Vietnam veteran war hero. They just smeared him mercilessly. And then the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, the same thing with Kerry, just bringing outright lies into the campaign. And I think that if anyone can show me a Democratic equivalent of that, I'd like to see it so I can know that Rove was just doing his job. Yeah. But I think he was just totally different. And I also read the other quote I think of is from Joe McCarthy era. How do you know sense of decency, sir? he didn't have any sense of decency. Rove didn't.
Bruce, thanks very much. Wayne Slater, let's come first to you with those. Karl Rove and the rules of politics. There, Susan takes us all the way back to his high school days in Utah when she says, you know, the principal or whoever laid down the rules, Karl Rove in high school broke every one. And then Bruce brings us right up to Max Cleland. And, of course, we could go on. Karl Rove and rules.
Well, let me mention two things, and I'll go back in history, back to, in one case, Karl Rove at Mount Olympus High School in Salt Lake City. Was this breaking of the rules, or was this just the skillful use of the rules that are there? I remember another story where when Karl was at Mount Olympus High School, he was a star debater. He was one of the best debaters in school, and that was a big extracurricular activity in high schools in Utah at the time, may still be. And one of the things Karl did was he understood that he'd walk in with a box of those debate cards. You remember In Debate where you have all these cards?
Index cards, yeah.
And the other guys would come in, the other team would come in with a box of debate cards. Karl would bring two, and the other team would bring two. Then he would bring four. And ultimately, when Rove and his partners would show up for the interscholastic, statewide competitions, he would come in with a cart filled with boxes with debate cards, pile them up on the desk. It was a function not of breaking the rules, but of using the rules to intimidate the other side. The truth is, those cards were almost all blank, but it was a technique that he used in the process of political, or in this case, debate warfare. I mentioned one other thing. It was more recent, though not as recent as the events of the presidency. In our book, Bush's Brain, we begin and end with an episode that takes some time to talk about, so I'll only say this about it. Karl was behind an effort to smear a couple of people in the agriculture department in Texas. And he did so with leaks and with working with the FBI, an FBI agent. Ultimately, there were indictments. And it was an effort to use government in his way to go after political and the law enforcement part to go after political opponents successfully. I look at the U.S. Attorney's scandal and I look at the Siegelman case as really mirrors of an early process where Karl has always used every tool at hand in order to win.
David Gergen, showmanship versus decency or indecency. Our caller Bruce says, you know, reminds us Clinton calling us a destruction machine, points to a kind of viciousness that our caller says, is, to his eye, puts it in a class of its own. Fair?
I think it's fair to say that there was a destruction machine and that they smeared people who got in their way. Just ask John McCain coming into the South Carolina primaries in 2000 against George W. Bush, and how, you know, they spread rumors that he had a black child and one thing and another illegitimately. And but is it unique? And is it unique to Republicans? That clearly is not the case. I think anybody who's read the history of the Franklin Roosevelt administration knows that they used a variety of similar techniques. In fact, you know, they got people's IRS records and exposed them for various things, or went after them in various ways. Look at what Lyndon Johnson did, going after that administration, and how they, you know, they tape people's phone calls and one thing and another. Let's not be too Puritan about this. But does Karl play right on the edge and sometimes go over the edge? Yeah, I think that's fair.
Let's get a noted conservative voice in this conversation. Grover Norquist joins us, leading conservative activist, president of Americans for Tax Reform, joins us today from Chautauqua, New York. Grover Norquist, thanks for being here.
Glad to be with you.
Karl Rove going out with an interview of Paul Jagot at the Wall Street Journal and sounding pretty upbeat. The president's numbers will come back, he says. Iraq will turn up. Republicans have a good shot at keeping the White House in 08. He calls Hillary Clinton. He says she'll probably be the candidate for the Dems, and she'll be tough, tenacious, and fatally flawed. How do you feel about the GOP's prospects for getting back on that permanent majority train as Karl Rove heads out?
Well, I think I'm pretty optimistic about it. The administration has moved forward to create more Americans who are shareholders, what they called the ownership society. The number of people who actually are managing their own pensions, their own 401ks, and that changes actually historically people's voting patterns. the Republicans lost seats in the House and the Senate in 06, largely because of the war in Iraq. That's not a permanent part of the Republican position. What you do when the war is in the rearview mirror rather than in the windshield for Republicans, we go back and look at 06 and say, did any Democrat win by saying, I want to raise your taxes, my Republican opponent doesn't. I want to spend more money than my Republican opponent. I want to steal your guns and my Republican opponent won't. I'm for abortions and my Republican opponent isn't.
When is that war going to be in the rearview mirror? Inquiring minds want to know.
Well, obviously, if we can be leaving as a gerund before 2008, meaning reducing the number of troops, we can bring other issues to the fore. And yes, Iraq makes it difficult to talk about other issues, but when you look at the issues of taxing and spending and where people want to go on individual liberty, the Republican candidates and the Republican issues are winning. They just had a vote in Iowa in the three liberal major counties there about whether or not to raise taxes to build bike paths and whatnot, and it was defeated 80-20. So the idea that somehow the American people want to return to high taxes and high spending and the 38,000 secret earmarks that the Democrats are trying to put forward, they're making all the mistakes the Democratic Party in 07 going into 08 that they made in 93 and 94.
And the Rovian permanent majority still there to be had, you think?
Well, I think it's a growing Republican, Reagan-Republican coalition. What Rove tacked on to was the Reagan-Republican coalition. There's nothing distinctively Bush about it. Where Bush was in sync with the Reagan approach, the Bush administration succeeded cutting taxes. Where it deviated from the Reagan campaign and coalition, it did less well.
Grover Norquist at Americans for Tax Reform, thanks for being with us.
You got it.
Jack, what do you make of that analysis? It's just waiting to get geared up again.
Well, I think there's one part of it that I would augment, and that is that I think the role of Bush politics succeeded by failing. I mean, I think government has been substantially delegitimized under this administration because of its really incompetent handling of one thing after another. In the immigration fight, again and again, you heard senators saying, well, if we can't take care of New Orleans, how can we deal with a problem as complicated as immigration? And I think in that sense, Rove won. I think I don't know what the polls say, but I think skepticism about the competence of government must now be at a high level, and that's actually because of the failures of the Bush administration. But those are ideological successes for conservatism.
David Gergen, how about it? Does Rove leave behind fertile soil for Reagan Republicanism, even if by government default?
No, I don't think so. I think that the the Bush years have, if anything, soiled the Reagan legacy, and it's harder for people to see it, what's happened here. And while I agree with Jack that certainly that the Katrina left people feeling government was totally incompetent, that also opens a vacuum for someone to come along and show that you can actually govern and get things done. That's the opportunity for Democrats if they win. Now, they've got to take advantage of it. We've seen people in the past. Reagan came in at a time when everybody thought the government was nobody could govern and nobody could lead. And people were talking in the late 70s about, Lloyd Cutler was talking about a constitutional convention to convert us into a parliamentary system because no president could govern. And along comes this highly improbable figure out of the West, coming in on his horse, and everybody thinks that he's a clown. He was the dunce, as Clark Clifford, the Democratic strategist, put it. And lo and behold, he actually governed and helped create a majority. Now that's the opening that Democrats have. That means that they've got, if they win the White House, they've got to govern well, they've got to lead well, and that's, to me, is the big question hanging over the Democratic Party right now. Is it prepared to govern well? And I think that's a very, very open question right now.
David Gergen, advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton at the Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Wayne Slater, last word goes to you. You followed him for a long time. What image of Karl Rove dances in your head as he's on his way out?
I think here is a guy who's extraordinarily optimistic about his confidence in making something happen, in using every gear and lever of government and of politics to win. The problem is that in the end, the actual practice of governance was not successful at all.
Wayne Slater, political writer for the Dallas Morning News, author of Bush's Brain and the Architect, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Karl Rove, leaving the White House, leaving George Bush's side, going home to Texas. We'll go out with a little Texas sound. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille.